Nikki Strong. This is VOA Weather Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Faith Perlow continues her everyday grammar lesson on describing favorite characters in a book or movie. Later, we hear the next part in our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Andrew Smith has this report.
Paris becomes the latest French city that will not broadcast World Cup games in public areas. An official says the city is concerned over rights violations of migrant workers and the environmental impact of the games in Qatar. Qatar is a small Arab nation in the Persian Gulf. Thousands of migrant workers, mostly from South Asia, have helped build stadiums, train lines, roads, and hotels to prepare for the World Cup. Human rights groups say these migrants have been mistreated and that some have died because of the working conditions. Qatar strongly disagrees and says it has improved the working conditions. The World Cup takes place every 4 years during the Northern Hemisphere summer. Because of the intense summer heat in Qatar, the World Cup will be held from November 20 to December 19 this year. Pierre Rabadan is a deputy mayor of Paris overseeing sports. He told France Bleu Paris Radio that air-conditioned stadiums and the conditions in which these facilities have been built are to be questioned. Paris Saint-Germain, the city's soccer team, is owned by Qatar Sports Investments. But Rabadan added that it doesn't prevent us to say when we disagree. A growing number of French cities have also refused to broadcast the games in public areas to protest Qatar's human rights record. The mayor of Strasbourg, a city in northeastern France, said that accusations of human rights abuses and poor treatment of migrant workers were the reason for canceling public broadcasts of the World Cup. She said in a statement, "We cannot turn a blind eye when human rights are violated." Environmentalists across France have also supported canceling outdoor public broadcasts. They say the viewings would use energy that the country has been saving for winter. In the southwestern city of Bordeaux, officials worry about the energy cost of outdoor public broadcasts in the winter cold. The French government wants to reduce the country's energy use by 10% to avoid the risk of cuts this winter. "We are trying hard to save energy," Bordeaux Mayor Pierre Urmic told the Associated Press. Arnaud Deland, a deputy mayor of Lille, said that by canceling public viewing of games, the city wanted to send a message to FIFA about the damage of the Qatar Games to the environment. FIFA is the world governing body for soccer. "We want to show FIFA that money is not everything," Deland said. I'm Andrew Smith.
Last week, we asked our readers and listeners to write about their favorite character from a book they had read. One reader, Arunab, wrote to us about their favorite character, Matilda, from the children's book with the same name. Matilda by Roald Dahl. In this week's Everyday Grammar, we will review parts of Arunab's description of Matilda.
Matilda is brilliant, resilient, creative, and kind, despite growing up in difficult circumstances. Her parents treat her poorly, but she manages to read books. Thus, she gets ahead of other children in her class. She also develops magical powers to defeat Miss Trunchbull. Matilda said, "Be outrageous. Go the whole hog. Make sure everything you do is so completely crazy, it's unbelievable." When Miss Trunchbull refuses to take Matilda to a higher form, Miss Honey continues to nurture her. She allows Matilda to read high-level textbooks, while the rest of her class learns simple reading and math.
Let us look at how Arunab first describes Matilda.
Matilda is brilliant, resilient, creative, and kind, despite growing up in difficult circumstances.
Arunab uses four adjectives to describe Matilda. Brilliant means very bright, and in this case, refers to Matilda's mind. She is very smart. Resilient is a good choice for describing Matilda. Because of her family, she has become very mentally strong. Arunab uses the preposition despite to contrast the surprising information that Matilda had a hard childhood. Growing up is a gerund, meaning to change from a child into an adult. We use the ing form of the verb to make a gerund, but unlike verbs, gerunds are nouns. Arunab describes Matilda as creative. Another word for this is imaginative. Children use their imaginations all the time. And lastly, he describes her as kind or caring and nice. Matilda is always looking out for her classmates and friends. Let's continue to the next part of the description.
Her parents treat her poorly, but she manages to read books. Thus, she gets ahead of other children in her class. She also develops magical powers to defeat Miss Trunchbull.
Arunab describes how other characters act towards Matilda. We find out how Matilda's parents treat her or behave towards her. He uses the adverb poorly to describe her parents' mistreatment of her. Another adverb, thus, is used in this paragraph. Thus is used to refer to a result of something that you just said. So because Matilda reads books, she was able to be at the top of her class. Arunab also uses descriptive verbs like develops and the infinitive form to defeat, which means to beat or win a victory over. In the next part of the description, we see Matilda's speech within quotation marks.
Matilda said, "Be outrageous. Go the whole hog. Make sure everything you do is so completely crazy, it's unbelievable."
Here, Matilda is talking about Miss Trunchbull's actions against her students. No one, not even the parents, believe how Miss Trunchbull is hurting her students. Go the whole hog is an idiom, meaning to do something completely or thoroughly. Lastly, let's look at the last group of sentences. And here we have some suggestions.
When Miss Trunchbull refuses to take Matilda to a higher form, Miss Honey continues to nurture her. She allows Matilda to read high-level textbooks, while the rest of her class learns simple reading and math.
In this paragraph, Miss Trunchbull does not want Matilda to move on to higher-level classes. We suggest replacing higher form and high level with the adjective advanced. We also see Miss Honey's reaction to Matilda's problem. Miss Honey then helps Matilda. Nurture is a good word choice for how Miss Honey is helping Matilda. Nurture means to encourage and care for, especially in growing, learning, and life. In today's report, we looked at Arunob's favorite character, Matilda. He described her with adjectives such as brilliant, resilient, and creative. He used descriptive verbs and adverbs to show how other characters behave towards Matilda. We learned new words like thus, an adverb, and despite, a preposition. We also learned a new idiom with the expression go the whole hog, which means to do something completely. We hope that over the last few weeks, you have enjoyed learning about ways to describe your favorite character. We thank Arunab for writing to us about Matilda. Great job! I'm Faith Perlow.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was the nation's first Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton firmly believed that no country could become a modern nation without industry. So he carefully developed a program that would make the United States an industrial nation. Part of his program protected American manufacturers from foreign competition. Hamilton protected them by establishing a system of import taxes on some foreign goods brought into American ports. These tariffs raised the prices of those goods. As a result, American manufacturers had much less competition in selling their products. Alexander Hamilton also organized the nation's finances. One of his first steps was to pay back the debt the country owed from the Revolutionary War. But Hamilton wanted to go much further. He wanted to establish a national bank. Hamilton argued that many European countries had national banks. University of Virginia history professor Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton saw the advantage of Britain's system. It permitted a very small country to go deeply into debt while fighting wars.
The British had essentially been able to project power well beyond their size thanks to a very efficient financial system and system of borrowing.
Hamilton said a national bank in America would increase the flow of money throughout the country. It would help the national government negotiate loans and collect taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says Hamilton believed a centralized bank would also keep the states from competing with each other.
Banks always have the problem is that they're in the money business. And so they're always tempted to lend too much and to speculate too much. And so he wanted a central mechanism to keep them on a short leash.
But Hamilton's plan raised old fears, especially among farmers in the South. Critics argued that a national bank would give too much power to a few rich men in the North. It would take control of state banks on which Southern farmers and small businessmen depended. It would also increase the use of paper money instead of gold and silver. James Madison led the opposition against Hamilton's plan in Congress. Madison said the United States should not put all its wealth in one place. So he proposed a system of many smaller banks in different parts of the country. He also argued that the idea of a central bank was unconstitutional. No one knew more about the American Constitution than James Madison. He was given credit for most of the ideas in it. Everyone respected his explanations of its wording. Madison noted that the Constitution gave Congress a number of powers which were stated. For example, the Constitution gave Congress the power to borrow money. But Congress could borrow money only to repay debts, to defend the country, and to provide for the general good of the people. Madison said permitting Congress to do more than what was in the Constitution was dangerous. Hamilton presented a very different view. His view came to be known as the implied powers doctrine. In other words, the Constitution includes powers without naming them. Business historian John Steele Gordon says this means that Congress can do whatever it needs to do to fulfill its duties unless the Constitution forbids it.
This is an argument that's been going on in the United States now for well over 200 years and probably will go on for another 200 years.
In 1790, Hamilton's view won more congressional support. He got enough votes to approve his proposal to establish a national bank. Still, President George Washington had to sign the bill into law. Washington worried about the possibility that the bill was not constitutional. So he asked three men for advice: Attorney General Edmund Randolph, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Randolph had no firm answer. Jefferson agreed with Madison. Creating a national bank violated the Constitution. Hamilton, of course, disagreed. He said the Constitution gave government a number of powers besides those written down. Otherwise, he said, the government could not work. These arguments did not completely answer all of President Washington's questions, but he went ahead and signed the bill to establish a national bank in America. One of its jobs was to maintain the value of the country's currency and to borrow money for the government. The National Bank also increased the flow of capital needed for investment. It fed the country's business and commercial activities, and it collected taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says America's financial success in the 1790s showed that Hamilton's plan worked.
It was known as the Hamiltonian miracle.
The National Bank and many of Hamilton's other ideas had another important effect. They created a disagreement that still exists. The disagreement began with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The two men were very different. Alexander Hamilton was born in the West Indies to a man and a woman who were not married. However, Hamilton was educated in America, and he gained a place in society by marrying the daughter of a wealthy landowner in New York State. Money and position were important to Hamilton. He believed men of money and position should govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson could have been what Alexander Hamilton wanted to be. Through his mother, he was distantly related to British noblemen, and he liked fine food, wine, books, and music. But Jefferson had great respect for simple farmers and for the men who opened America's western lands to settlement. He believed they, too, had a right to govern the nation. University of Virginia historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says both Hamilton and Jefferson believed they were defending the ideals of the American Revolution. And, he says, their disagreement revealed their fears. Professor O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton remembered the chaos under the country's first weak government. He was afraid the government would collapse and there would be social anarchy.
John Adams and Alexander Hamilton felt that differences were breaking down too much and that it would lead to a breakdown in authority.
On the other hand, he says, Jefferson and his supporters were afraid that the American Revolution would, like most revolutions, fail. A small elite group would control the country again. In other words, they were afraid of tyranny. Hamilton and Jefferson's personal disagreements turned into a public dispute when they served in President Washington's cabinet. The president tried to make peace between them. He liked them and respected them. He believed the new nation needed the skills of both men. However, the disagreement became more than just a question of two strong men who could not agree. It became a battle of two completely different philosophies of government. Those who supported Hamilton became known as the Federalist Party. The Federalists supported a strong national government with a powerful president and courts. In the early 1790s, the Federalists controlled the Congress. They also had great influence over President Washington. Most Federalists lived in the cities of the Northeast. They were the nation's bankers and big businessmen. They were lawyers, doctors, and clergymen. But at the time, the majority of Americans were farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. Many were bitter over government policies that always seemed to help the wealthy. They had no political party to speak for them. These were the people Thomas Jefferson wanted to reach. Jefferson's task was big. Many of these Americans knew little of what was happening outside their local area. Many were not permitted to vote because they did not own property. Jefferson looked at the situation in each state. Almost everywhere, he found local political groups fighting against state laws that helped the rich. These local groups were what Jefferson needed. He worked to bring them together into a national party to oppose the Federalists. The party came to be called the Jeffersonian Republicans, or just the Republicans. It may sound confusing, but today many of Jefferson's ideas are expressed by the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. This is because of changes in parties and party names over the years. In Jefferson and Hamilton's time, says Professor O'Shaughnessy, the idea of organized political parties was new in America.
Today we would regard the existence of party politics as essential for the functioning of democracy. There needs to be a minority view expressed. Government needs to be held accountable by an opposing party.
But at that time, he says, the people who fought in the American Revolution expected to be united. As a result, the country did not have any laws governing what political parties could or could not do. There were no restrictions on the political activities of government officials. So Hamilton and Jefferson carried on a war of words in their party newspapers. Jefferson especially felt the need for newspapers in a democracy. He believed they provided the only way for a large population to know the truth. He once said, if he had to choose between a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he would choose newspapers without a government. Both parties' newspapers carried unsigned articles attacking the opposition. Both printed stories that were false. At times, the attacks were personal. Many people felt the two cabinet secretaries should be above that kind of public fighting. But Professor O'Shaughnessy says that did not stop them.
The party politics became as bad as at any time in history.
Toward the end of President Washington's first administration, he received a letter from Jefferson. The Secretary of State said he planned to resign. He said he disagreed with most of the administration's domestic and foreign policies. He did not name Hamilton. It was not necessary. Washington knew what he meant. Hamilton was the chief planner of those policies. But Jefferson decided not to resign. In a letter to his daughter, Jefferson said the attacks on him changed a decision which he did not think could possibly be changed. He must remain and fight. So while continuing to serve as Secretary of State, Jefferson began working to get his supporters elected to Congress. He believed that was the only way to fight Hamilton. National elections were set for 1792.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.